Welcome to the Music Ed Matters podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Williams-Birch, and this podcast, it exists for you. Whether you're a music lover, an educator, a choir member, each week we bring guests to the show to help explore what matters in music. I'm so glad that you're here. Welcome to the show. Today's show features friend, composer, YouTube extraordinaire, Jesse Strickland. Jesse shares with us ideas of how he got started on his YouTube channel, along with his compositional styles. We actually do a repertoire exploration and look at some of his choral and solo works, and we talk about some of his instrumental works. We even loop back to how do we overcome barriers. Spoiler alert, get ready to build those jetpacks. Y'all, I am so pleased to introduce you to composer, professor, theorist, amazing human, Mr. Jesse Strickland. All right, today on the podcast, we are welcoming composer, teacher, amazing friend, extraordinaire, Jesse Strickland. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Emmy. It's good to be here.
It's so good to see you. We met in grad school. Mm-hmm. I was a doctorate. You were a master's student, but right. You were so smart. I didn't know you were a master's student.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thought you were a doctorate.
Hopefully soon.
Yeah, good. Oh, that's great to hear. You are wonderful. For people listening, who is Jesse Strickland? Give us your elevator pitch, although it can be longer than an elevator ride because you're awesome.
So I am a composer. I am a music theorist. I would say I dabble in filmmaking as well.
Yes, you do.
Most of my compositions are sacred texts that have been set for either mixed choirs or TTBB, but I also love chamber works and orchestral works as well. But mostly I've been working in as composer in residence at my church in Auburn, writing for their choir and orchestra. Did that back before grad school, and now I'm back in that role now that I'm back in Auburn. And I'm also teaching music theory at the university. So it's a really sweet gig. So
that's awesome. So you're composer in residence, mm-hmm. You're teaching theory and oral skills and all that jazz.
That's right.
You have to talk about your YouTube channel. Because yes. I'm pretty sure that is how I passed orchestral conducting. Like, I think I watched the episode on how to transpose the instruments 100 times.
Yes. So back in 2015, I got a request from a buddy of mine who's a middle school band director. And he was like, Jesse, all of the videos on YouTube about music theory are like 30 minutes long and they're hard to understand. Could you make some videos just on the basics of music for my band students to watch? And so I made a couple about like how to read clefs and what is pitch and how to count rhythms and stuff like that. And then it just became this little side project that I was doing. And then I made a video in early 2016 on how to build the circle of fifths. And it went as viral as any of my videos have ever gone. And so every year since I've done it in 2015, it's doubled. And I get requests from teachers all over the country. I know it's being used in high schools and middle schools and in colleges. Which is really, really cool. As of a few months ago, it had been seen in 68 different countries. And here recently, I actually started partnering with BoClips, which is an educational platform where teachers who don't have access to YouTube can subscribe, and they have access to all of this educational material from Crash Course to Minute Physics and stuff from the Smithsonian and TED Talks. So it's really, really cool opportunity. And I'm there kind of as the music representative for teachers across the world who don't have access to YouTube. So really cool opportunity there.
That is wonderful. I know if you guys don't know 2-Minute Music Theory, I will put the link in the episode notes. But definitely some of the super short blurbs on just common theory words have been incredibly helpful, especially as my college students are reviewing for their praxis and all their teaching exams. How did you get into the history side of things? I actually just watched all of the Eastern music history mm-hmm. that you put up because I just taught a class on world music and it was very enlightening. How did you get into all that?
Well, I've always been interested in music history as well. And one of the things that sort of caught my attention during grad school, actually, I was doing a project on the history of the Protestant Reformation and the music that came out of that, both in Germany and France. And then
weren't we in that class together?
We were,
yes. We were in that class together. I remember this presentation. Okay, very interesting. Yes, continue.
That's right. So I was doing this history of the Protestant Reformation, and I was like, I'm going to make a video about it. And so that kind of became a pilot episode, so to speak. And as I was doing that, I sort of realized that the music history books kind of leave out what was going on in the culture as that music was being written, because music doesn't exist in a vacuum and all of these things. And so the Protestant Reformation and the music that was coming out of it was directly influenced by the Catholic Church and the King of France. And I was like, you know, that would be really cool to talk about in music history classes. And then I kind of did some digging on YouTube and realized that no one had done a history of music series. And so I was like, okay, well, I got to jump on that. And so I wanted it to be very much not a typical music history class. And so I'm going to be talking about music history from around the world, and not just the music and the composers, but, you know, rather the culture that was around the music, that created the music, who was performing, what music was valued, what music was oppressed, you know, what the culture thought of music as a whole and art as a whole. So it's been a fun project, but it's very time consuming. And a lot of people are like, when's the next video coming up? And I'm like, look, I'm doing like a 12-page research paper on top of all of my other stuff. So,
yes. Oh, I know. I was helping just look for some things for one of your upcoming episodes that you're making. And I went down such a rabbit hole. It ended up taking almost my entire day. And I didn't even have a paper or anything to show. It was just all this stuff I had read that was so fascinating. But we go down the research rabbit hole. Exactly. And it was so much fun. What you're talking about, though, just makes me think I just released an episode, a Doctor is In episode, and one of my intro to music students had asked, where does genres come from? Sorry for any of the noise outside. I live near an airplane base, and they've been flying massive planes by all day. Just those really loud ones that you kind of want to see what's falling out of the sky. Anyway.
No problem. I got a train track right outside, too. So we'll
great. That makes me feel a little bit better. Anyway, so one of the questions was, where does genres come from? And going into that study from the History of Rock and Roll Club course that I taught, you see that it's 100% related to what was going on culturally. Like rock and roll came because of the rise of the teenager, and the Beatles came because, like, there's a whole bunch of, well, this was happening, so this is what music looked like. And you're doing this for other cultures. How are you finding this information? What type of resources are you using?
So I have I don't know if I can find it right offhand. I actually, for the first one, I was like, Mesopotamian music is the oldest possible music I can come up with. And so that's where I started. And I'll be honest, that first episode was a little bit just chaotic in terms of organized research. And as I've kind of gone on, I've actually like formalized a workflow in terms of where to start. You know, don't tell any of my professors, but Wikipedia is often because I don't know what I don't know. So I go there to see what all there is. And then I'm like, okay, now I have something I can go type into JSTOR or Rillum or something like that.
Those files at the end are a great resource. I actually had a teacher once say, if you're going to start at Wikipedia, don't cite it. Just go to the end and see what sources they use. And that's a great place because you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. And so there have been plenty of times that I've found something on Wikipedia and it's got the article or the book right there. And then I go track down the book and I'm like, whoa, this has way more than I thought. And so the episode that's coming up is on Greek music. And right now it's at 42 sources.
So
it's growing out of control. And so I'm fortunate to have access to, you know, JSTOR and all of these academic databases, as well as the Auburn Music Library. And so that's where a lot of it's coming from, but especially for like the Chinese episode that the music of the Zhou Dynasty had to contact some Chinese scholars, because that's, I mean, and then the episode after Greek music will be music of the Gupta Empire, which is India right about the same time as classical Greece. And so just very, very far outside of my knowledge because, you know, Tereskin didn't cover that.
No, Tereskin didn't. But isn't it so fascinating having, I'm wrapping up this world music class. I've officially taught all the regions. All that's left is a quick dive into what is ethnomusicology. That's the only lecture left for me to record. Mm. And it's fascinating how deep I literally would just spend hours watching scholars talk about the culture and the community and different trade routes and things that we don't know about or we aren't taught. It's, I love that you've gone that way. And it's also just a good analogy for life. You don't know the answer or you see a void, just jump in and fill it. Might take some work and some research, but you know how to get started.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun and I'm excited to see where it goes because I mean, the further I go down and the closer that I get to like, you know, modern stuff, the more there is for me to find. So
well, whenever you get to the decades of rock and roll, you just call me.
All right. That sounds great.
Totally collaborate. It's my jam. Definitely. So I have a question. How does all this line up with your compositional life?
Well, I am just, I'm very interested in a lot of things just in general. And so to me, the academics within music, you know, that are covered at the Academy, you know, are kind of history, theory, and composition. And so to me, they're all very interconnected. So I'm a composer who is not disconnected from all of the composers that have gone before me. And being that I love theory, a lot of my composition also is based on, I have some sort of pre-compositional process that I'm working on, either whether that be rotational arrays or, you know, with my, I did my thesis using a microtonal diatonicism. And so there's always some sort of pre-compositional mathematical, theoretical sort of thing that goes into the piece, depending on whether that be the emotion, the emotional journey I'm wanting to take the audience on, or if it's a piece with text, how, you know, what emotions are driving the text. So to me, history, theory, and composition are all interconnected.
So it's like life and music. It's all interconnected. Right. You always have a pre idea. Would you put yourself in the same category as like Crumb and Cage and that likes?
Not necessarily. In that I want more control over what happens than Cage and Crumb. I think they were just like, okay, here are some parameters and now let's just see what the piece does. Yep. Let's see where it goes. Right. I want some more control over that, but I think of it more in terms of maybe Stravinsky is a better, you know, where he said, you know, art has a canvas. And so in the same way, composers must put themselves on a canvas, so to speak. And so the pre-compositional stuff that I do is really more just like, these are the parameters. I'm going to stick within this harmonic landscape. I'm going to force myself to these specific timbres or, you know, so it's really more just a way of setting boundaries so that the choices are not infinite.
Have you felt that your pre-compositional ideas or your boundaries have changed as you've morphed from graduate school to a job back to the university teaching? What have you seen changing in your parameters in your style?
Yeah, so one of the more useful pieces of advice that I ever got was because, like I said, I'm very interested in a lot of things and a lot of genres. My composition professor at South Carolina said, "Well, you've kind of got like a musical multiple personality disorder going on," and so as I have moved forward, I'm trying to kind of mesh together all of the different things that I like, all the genres that I like. And so that has certainly changed. And then the other thing that has changed is rather than being, you know, one type of composer, just trying to grab all of the different, techniques that, I've learned, whether that, you know, that minimalism or even, you know, indeterminacy, and just using those as different tools that they're part of a tool belt rather than, a composer defining, genre that I would put myself in. So that certainly has changed, is seeing different compositional techniques as tools rather than as, you know, identifiers.
I like that. Kind of like when you introduce yourself to someone, I don't want to just be a professor. That's not my identifier. I want to be a human. And that's just part of who I am. I think that's a great great way of looking at it. So let's flip this and look at this episode now as a repertoire exploration episode. Can we look at some of your pieces of music? I know you just released something on all your favorite music platforms.
That's right.
So tell us about that piece. Walk us through the compositional process. Maybe play a little bit of it if you want to.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll go ahead and back out a little bit further. The single that just released is called How Merciful You Are to Break Me, in parentheses, which is a very raw and personal song, just in my personal relationship with God. Some things that he has taught me over the last 7 or 8 years, really. But it's part of a larger project. There's going to be two albums that are going to be released sort of as fraternal twins, so to speak. They will be very much like each other, but this is where sort of the world blending comes together, because it's very much modern music, sort of a modern worship type genre. But it's the first album is called Evensong, and it's the structure of an Evensong service. And so it's got the Anglican influence there. And so I'll be doing a Magnificat and a Nunc and with some prayers.
But with a modern twist.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. I can't wait to see this, because, you know, I'm a huge, huge fan of that Anglican service. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Love the Evensong service. And so it's going to have a lot of choral elements as well.
Okay.
That are blended in with, you know, guitars and drums and mandolins and banjos and pianos. It's going to be great.
Okay. When is this? Like, is there a timeline on this, or just coming in the future?
Yeah, coming. That's the reason that the single released is because I had intended to release the album right around now, and, well, you know, life and...
Yes, COVID and all that jazz.
Yeah.
So exactly. Tell us about the single. Does the single give us a flavor of the whole project, or is it each thing very individual?
So I think it does give a nice sort of introduction to the world of the project.
Okay.
There will be some other elements that were not present in that particular song, but a lot of the elements are present. And so it starts off. Some people have called it Asian. What it actually is, it's my acoustic guitar and I'm just playing harmonics.
Ooh.
And so the entire opening verse is four of my acoustic guitar playing different harmonic riffs, which I thought was really, really cool, because I wrote a lot of the songs for the project. It's just me and a guitar, and so it's got a singer-songwriter type vibe. And that wasn't what I was going for. And so as I was doing the arrangements for the project, I was like, okay, well, how can I change this? And I was just playing around one day and was playing around with some harmonics to actually tune the guitar. And I was like, ooh, I really like that. And so it kind of spun out of control from there. And yeah. And so that's kind of how it opens. And so it's very, very exposed in a lot of ways, because it's just my voice and a guitar. And then, sort of in that, I guess like a cathartic sort of release, it gets really big in the middle, just realizing that, you know, what the Lord has brought me through and what seemed very painful experiences at the time, were actually acts of mercy to have kept me from something much, much worse. Often that being myself, and so it draws a lot, the two verses in the bridge, which that sounds a little bit confusing in the first place. The form of the song is not really obvious, but there's two sections to the bridge, and they both draw on the story of when Peter walks on the water in the Gospels. And he, as long as he keeps his eyes on Jesus, he's walking on the water. But the second that he looks at the storm that's happening, he starts to sink. And so I kind of put myself in Peter's shoes for the bridge.
That's a cool way to implement like a Bible story into this personal experience. Well, I have it pulled up and I can input a little clip of it if that's okay with you.
Sounds great. Yeah, go for it.
Gave your life to set me free. How could I ever doubt your goodness to me? I'm learning that I'm still depraved.
as you said, you're creating like a hodgepodge. You could have just done just intonation. You could have just done the harmonics. But instead, you're really making a new complete sound.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's all sorts of stuff.
So that's a solo one. And you said there'll be other movements of this entire evensong that have choral aspects. Let's talk about some of your choral music.
Okay.
Pick any of them. I've only heard two of your originals.
So I'm assuming you've heard Hymn of Habakkuk.
Yes.
Okay, that's the popular one. So at the time when I wrote Hymn of Habakkuk, so just for a little bit of backstory, Habakkuk is a minor prophet in the Old Testament. And he sees the world around him and how Israel is not doing well. And he's like, okay, God, what are you doing? And the Lord's like, okay, well, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do, but you're not going to believe it. And then he says, okay, all of this destruction is coming to Israel. And Habakkuk's like, well, that's not cool. You should do it another way. And so the Lord's like, no, I'm going to do it this way and you should trust me. And so at the end of it all, Habakkuk goes, okay, even though all of this stuff is terrible, even though there's no food and the cattle have all died and everything's bad, yet I will rejoice. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. And so that's the little header in the Bible, which is not part of scripture, it's editorial, but the header on my Bible for that passage was the Hymn of Habakkuk. And so that's where the title comes from.
I would just like to insert that we should have more Bible stories told by Jesse Strickland, because that was a very entertaining Bible story. This is probably why you have a successful YouTube channel. I'm like, oh, it's a great Bible story. I've read that one before, but this is way more interesting. Okay, keep going.
I appreciate it. Yeah, so at the time, I was really into Victoria, a Renaissance composer. Still am very into Victoria. His Omanium Mysterium is...
Yes.
Wonderful. Yes. And so...
if you don't know that, that's public domain. I could play a little snippet of that right
you
now.
Can do that. The staggered entrances all take place on a fifth, as a nice little shout out to Victoria himself, because that's how Omanium Mysterium starts. But from there, it's a polyphonic setting of the text. And so soprano, alto, tenor, bass, it's really SATB divisi, because I'm not sure how often there's actually only four parts. But It's very, very polyphonic, and the text is just overlapping the entire time. And then it gets to, and though there be no herds in the stalls, and that was actually one of my favorite compositional devices that I've ever used, because the sopranos are moving in parallel seconds, the altos are moving in parallel fourths, the tenors are moving in parallel thirds, and the basses are moving in parallel fifths.
That's a great idea.
And so it creates all of these like descending, I don't know, cluster chords is probably the best way to describe them. But then after all of that, you get to the line, and yet I will rejoice. And for the first time in the entire piece, everyone is on a unison E flat.
Ooh, which is a great note anyway.
Just goes up from there. And so you get that, you've got all of this tumultuous stuff that's being talked about. There's no food. There's the olive branch is not producing fruit anymore. The herds are gone, and there's no cattle in the stalls. And so all of this tumultuous stuff in the polyphonic section, but then it becomes homophonic as the choir resolvedly says, yet I will rejoice. And so that's the more popular one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I really enjoy it. The South Carolina Chamber Choir did an incredible job touring that one.
Yes, so. That was the year before I got there, but it was still the greatest hit. Everyone talked about it.
Yeah, so that one's still probably my most popular. Here recently, I've been I've been working on a couple. One is, it's called Rejoice and Hope. It's comes from Romans 12.
Okay.
The text there is rejoice and hope, be constant in tribulation, persevere in prayer. And so that's the centerpiece of the song, but that one will, I don't know.
It's why not?
it's on the docket. We'll see when it gets done.
You basically have a pipeline of everything you said at the beginning. You have films that are, you know, music history films and music theory films that are coming. You have courses that you're preparing. You have this awesome Evensong, and then you are also doing choral stuff. I mean, you're living exactly your dream, right?
Absolutely, I am. It's no, I wake up every day and know that, because I go to the university and teach for a bit, and then I come home and work on YouTube and compositions, and it's fantastic.
That is awesome. So for someone who's listening and wants to check out your music, where should they start?
You know, that's a good question, because there is that divide between like classical and modern. And so I guess it would be step number one is like, what are you sort of looking for? Are you looking for something more modern? If you're looking for something more modern, then Spotify is probably a good place to go.
Okay.
It's got my first album, LOL, came out in 2012. I sound really young. The lyrics are really young, but it's there.
You were really young.
Yeah, I was really young. It was, 8 years ago. Wow. My website has got a complete list of, my website has the modern stuff too. But my website has got a complete list of works, whether that be classical or modern, and some stuff that just does not fit into a box, because...
you don't have to always fit in a box.
Exactly. So my work for Lakeview kind of fits in that modern / classical hybrid. Mm-hmm. It's for choir and orchestra, but it's for a modern Baptist choir and orchestra. And so there's a Christmas musical that I wrote in 2015 that's up on the website.
Christmas musical.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so for people who want to check out your YouTube channel, which one would you tell them to watch first?
I think the video that I'm most proud of is the Augmented Six video. I think that one's the one that I just nailed.
That's game changer, by the way. I also watched that a few dozen times.
So
that's a really good one.
If you know nothing of music, then the first episode that's up on the channel is called What is Music Theory? And then there's a playlist called Music Theory 101 or something to that regard. That's a good place to start. Hopefully on the 2 Minute Music Theory website soon, I will be one of the directions we're going is that I will actually have complete online courses on the music theory. On the 2 Minute Music Theory website. So as a resource for teachers.
That would be such a great resource. That's one of the reasons that I reached out to you in the first place. We hadn't talked in a few months. I hadn't seen you since we had been in New York.
Yeah.
And I gave you a shout out on one of the Doctor Is In episodes. I think episode 26 or something. One of the students asked, should I learn to read music or should I play by ear? How do I get started? And I actually shouted out 2 Minute Music Theory. Yeah. Because it has a lot of really great how to get started tips and tools embedded within it. So to hear that you're doing courses coming soon, that's exciting.
Yeah. So the basically like first semester music theory in terms of like Western classical harmony, it's done. Like it's ready to go. So if you're like an AP, if you're teaching AP or if you're just a band director or choir director looking for, you know, theory one stuff, that's ready to go. But I'm looking at doing three courses on Western harmony and then doing a post-tonal course as well.
Yes.
Expanding, because I mean, of course, the history stuff is coming along slowly as well.
What about counterpoint? I always wish I would have taken a counterpoint class, but counterpoint classes for the doctorate always interfered with another thing I had to be in. I wanted counterpoint class so bad. Can you do some counterpoint?
Absolutely, I can. So that is,
I will be there.
We're coming up on, I'm doing The sort of the next three things that are coming are 16th and 18th century counterpoint, yes. Post-tonal. I'm working on an episode on rotational arrays right now.
Sign me up for that too. OMG. That was my favorite theory class.
Love rotational arrays. And then also I'm reworking a fundamentals of music theory that I don't even talk about notation until the very end of it.
Good.
So talking about what is pitch from, you know, a basic standpoint, what is rhythm and what is timbre, and looking at them not in terms of how we have classified them in Western tonal harmony, mm-hmm. but how do music theories around the world classify pitch? How do they organize pitch? How do they use rhythm? What sorts of timbres are used? So that's sort of the next three things up in 2 minute music theory.
All right, I have three questions left for you in my head. Okay. I'm going to interrupt for just a minute before we dive into the jetpack that I promised you at the beginning. This show is brought to you by the Kinnison Choral Company. Make sure you check out all of their fabulous resources at kinnisoncoralco.com. Use the code MUSICMATTERS at checkout to save 20%. Thanks, Kinnison Choral Company. We absolutely adore and appreciate all that you do. This might become four because it was just one a second ago, but now it's three. Okay, so for someone listening who wants to get started building a YouTube channel, mm-hmm. what are some of your tips or suggestions before they get started?
Number one is find what no one else is doing and do that. Because I am not the only music theory YouTuber. In fact, I'm one of the smaller ones, but I am the only one that's doing, you know, 2 to 4 minute installations. And I'm also on the more academic side of things as a resource for teachers, rather than a lot of the YouTubers that are doing analysis of modern music. And so just find something. I mean, if you're interested in a subject, find something that no one else is doing and do that, and then do it really, really well. Yes. And then like definitely invest in the stuff that it's going to take to make it look and sound good. At this point, I mean, your iPhone on a tripod has a good enough capability, but I would probably invest in an external microphone and a recorder just to make sure that, because I mean, the iPhone microphone is still not as good as an external. So, and then I don't actually know what all is available on the market in terms of cheap or free video editors. I use the Adobe Suite and have been using the Adobe Suite since we were using tape decks to manually transfer video.
I just recently upgraded from iMovie. So I still use iMovie for editing a lot of the podcast stuff because I just learned how to do that with my friend Chris Muntz. I did use GarageBand, but have since updated it to Logic Pro. And nice. I use iMovie for simple edits, but I love Final Cut Pro.
Okay.
There are so many things you can do with it, but iMovie is a DAW, a free digital audio workstation, right?
Well, yeah, it's
with the video
editing.
Yeah.
Logic is a DAW.
That's it. Well, there's so much you can do with those things. Okay, those are some good tips. You ready for the next question?
Yeah, absolutely.
What about a composer who doesn't fit in a box that is wanting to get started and explore all the different things? What would you suggest to a composer listening?
So for me, one of the things that I had to realize in my journey, being that I kind of don't fit into a box, was that my path as a composer was not going to look like a lot of my peers. And so they're applying for competitions or going to festivals in the summer or doing whatever it is that is the traditional composer sort of route. And you can get bogged down in all of that. Especially that my first semester out of grad school, I would sit down and I'd be like I was writing a piano sonata that I did not care about. Because I felt like it was the thing that I was supposed to be writing based on the things that I had been supposed to be writing in grad school, you know, the things that they were requiring me to write. And so in all of that, write the music you want to write and figure out how to find your voice, even if you like rap and also opera and also, you know, fill in the blank with
disco. You know, you got to rap, opera, and disco.
Exactly.
There you go.
Right. And so if you want to write rap opera disco, then write it. And you know, because if you like it, there's a chance that somebody else is going to like it too. But just don't be afraid to not be on the same path as all of your other peers that are doing the same thing. So I mean, if you're thinking in terms of like everyone's climbing a ladder, they're trying to get somewhere, they're trying to get to the top of a platform. Well, instead of climbing the ladder, just like, I don't know, build a jetpack.
Yes. Oh, that's quotable. Instead of climbing the ladder, build a jetpack. Yes, that's thank right. you. Thank you. Okay. So you don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, and we can cut this out if you don't like this question. But it's one of my favorite things about you. When I first met you, you were already talking about potentially going straight through grad school into your doctorate, mm-hmm. and you actually hit some roadblocks and were told no. For someone who is staring down the path that they want to go, but they can't seem to get through the roadblock, other than building a jetpack, mm-hmm. what are some things that really helped you overcome? And to hear you saying that you're looking back at getting your doctorate makes me super stoked, because you are the type of people that need to be in higher ed. You are so strong and such a great educator, but you're also a great musician. So I'm super stoked to hear that. But what are some things you would tell someone listening who sees a blockade in front? What do you do? How did you get through that?
Yeah, that's a great question there, because what she's referring to is that I was going to go get a doctorate immediately after my master's, and my primary professor, I went into his office and I was like, okay, it's time to apply. Who should I apply to? And he's like, don't. And I was like, okay, here we are. And he was like, you want to be a writer, just go be a writer. You don't need a doctorate to go write. And then, so I moved to New York City to do church planning and to do freelance composition. And it was tough. New York is a tough, oversaturated composition market. And so, I mean, there's a lot of cool scenes there. One of the great things about New York was that, you know, any genre was there. If you wanted to do jazz or Broadway or opera, rap, whatever, didn't matter, classical, all the genres are there. And so that was really cool, but it was really, really difficult. And so honestly, I have to give a lot of credit to Sovereignty that just moved me into right places, because, you know, I ended up getting involved at Juilliard and was working at their bookstore just to try to get involved in the music community and just see what all was going on in the classical world. And, you know, it was not, again, you know, there were more roadblocks. And then actually started dating my now wife last fall. And that actually led me into the where I am now. And so because of her job, I moved back to Auburn. And when my former department chair at Auburn, because I graduated from Auburn in 2012, and so the department knows me. And so my department head sent me an email. He was like, hey, I heard you're back in town, let's chat. And so that's how I ended up in this Auburn position. And so all that being said, it's a bit of a ramble, but you know, I got the Auburn job because my interview was basically a YouTube channel that I had started for fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had gone on and done other things that Auburn doesn't offer. Auburn doesn't really have a composition program. And so all of these things that I had done in my past that seemed inconsequential eventually landed me exactly where I am now, and has kind of set me up, because I'm banking on that teaching at a D1 school is going to look pretty good on a doctoral application.
Looks pretty good on an application.
That's what I'm banking on. And so all of these inconsequentially seeming things led me to where I am now and will continue leading me. Mm-hmm.
You just didn't give up. You kept working hard. You didn't let it steal mm-hmm. your joy. I think that is such a great success story. I love watching you. Part of this is I want to capture an early episode with you, because I know that over the course of my little passion project, you'll be back. You'll be back on the show. You'll be doing other things. There'll be more stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
But this is great. All right. The last question I always ask, mm-hmm. what is one thing that really matters? This podcast is called Music Matters. What's something that matters? Something you want the listener to walk away with?
So I would say there's a couple of things in blending theory and composition. one of the things that I would like to instill in my students, and even just say to the broader music community, is that I think all musicians, whether they be ed or performance, ethnomusicologist, whatever it is that you're passionate about within music, I think all musicians should be composers. We talk about music, and I mean, we speak English, and it would be absurd for us to not be able to write English as well. And so the fact that we talk about music and we learn music, and it's like, oh no, writing is just for the composers, is a bit absurd to me as well. And so that's one of the things that I, as a theorist and composer, want to say to the broader music community. But then also, just with what I was saying earlier, find your voice, because the world does not need more of the voices that already exist. We need your music. And so even if that's hard, even if you get stuff from publishers that's like, well, this is beautiful, but it's not really sellable, you know, true story. So, you know, even if you're getting stuff like that from publishers, just write your music, because that is really what the world needs. Music is so very powerful, and I don't think it's any argument that we need music right now.
Amen. So. Yeah, we do. Oh, Jesse, thank you for doing this. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing everything. You're wonderful.
This has been a lot of fun, and excited to have you on an episode of Music and History.
Yes, I'm so excited for that. All right, thank you so much. You get to do you. Find a space to be you. It doesn't have to be anything else. Be proud of who you are. Look at what Jesse's accomplished. Great music. Awesome content on YouTube. Make sure you check that out, 2 Minute Music Theory. And so much more. And to see that he is glowing. You can't see his face because this is audio, but he's absolutely glowing, doing exactly what he's on this planet to do. So whatever you're doing right now, know that you, my friend, you matter. What you're doing, it really does matter. We all know that music matters. And I'll see you next time on the Music Matters podcast.